Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Boredom is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly.
Sex, sex.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school,
know about
pain and suffering,
learning and teaching.
In your face, in your face, in your face.
Listen to your words that they be preaching, cause here's the education gadfly show. Yeah.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my guest co-host from the New America Foundation, Sarah Mead.
Hey, Michael.
How are you, Sarah?
I'm doing well. You know, I just launched a new blog, earlyeducationwatch.com, and so that's an exciting development in my life lately.
Sarah, I'm so impressed. You know, the one condition Sarah had for coming on the show was being able to plug her blog, which we, of course, said that was fine. We're all about plugging. We plug our own stuff all the time. But you didn't even, I mean, right off the bat.
Well, you asked me what's going on, and that's what I've been working on lately.
Sarah, you are a real professional. I mean, we could really learn something from you about staying on message. I was just telling Jeff here, who's our communications director, about how Sarah published was probably the education report that got more press than any other I've ever seen. About a year and a half ago, this piece about the war on boys and whether or not boys are really doing poorly or not. But I think this is it. This is the secret. You stay on message.
Well, and if you write about gender, you'll get lots and lots of press no matter what you write, basically.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you know, Liam is trying to write about race and see if he gets lots and lots of press.
Yeah, that's a provocative issue lately, I think.
Yeah, but so far he just gets called racist. So that hasn't worked out for him quite
as
well.
Not really going to go there.
Yeah. But so what do you think about Senator Obama's speech this week? Got a big headline on race.
I think it's definitely gotten a lot of, you know, interesting reactions from people. I actually didn't get a chance to watch it because I was at work. So
okay. Yeah, you know, some interesting things about education. Talks a little bit about, you know, how schools are still just as segregated today as 50 years ago. I don't know. I mean, do you think that's fair to say? Did we kind of put that out there?
That schools are just as segregated as they were in the past. I mean, schools are highly segregated right now, and I think that if you look at how that relates to housing trends, it shouldn't be any surprise. But I think that is something that should be troubling in terms of our broader conversation about what does it mean to be sort of a coherent society and have a coherent, you know, common vision of what it means to be an American.
Yeah. Well, Liam has a piece on National Review this week arguing the other point. You know, basically, well, Liam, what do you think? You know, it's not interested in saying he's cat's got his tongue, but, you know, basically saying, look, you know, yes, a lot of schools are racially isolated today, but that's very different from segregation when, you know, by law, African-American kids couldn't go to certain schools, you know, and much less, you know, what are we, you know, Obama himself in the speech talked about how, you know, busing is not exactly a popular remedy for that. So it's just not clear where we go with that. I mean, what do we ever do about that? But maybe the New American Foundation has an idea.
Well, stay tuned, and I'm sure you'll hear more about it. We've got some people doing some interesting work on race issues coming out in the next year or so. So stay tuned.
Do you ever talk about race issues on your early education blog?
I haven't yet, just because there haven't been any big early education and race-related incidents. But I'm sure I'll get an opportunity to write about it sometime in the future.
We'll look for that. But you did write, I understand, about Governor Spitzer, and you had some sort of connection to early education.
Well, sure. I mean, Governor Spitzer has been a huge proponent of pre-K and a big champion for it in New York State. So I think a lot of people in the early ed world, particularly in New York, when they heard about this, were worried, what does this mean for, you know, his promise to get to universal pre-K in New York? And I think fortunately, we know that David Paterson has been a huge supporter of education reform and funding both, which is, you know, an exciting package of, you know, speaking of race, a reform-minded African-American politician, and somebody we should be watching happens there. And then also the state legislature has really been pushing on pre-K there, so I don't think that push is going to go away.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a nice tie-in. That wasn't really, you didn't really go for any of the prostitute jokes or anything like that.
No, this is a family blog that I run, Mike.
Good. Well, yeah, I guess literally it is. Okay. Yeah. Well, lots to cover today. We're going to, of course, play a game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we will hear our education outrage of the week, and Liam will impart some education news of the weird. So, Liam filling in for Christina, who's on vacation for Easter right now. Liam, let's get started with a game of Pardon the Gadfly.
Sounds good. Question one. The new proposal from Secretary Margaret Spellings for a, quote, differentiated accountability pilot program, unquote, is this A, common sense move toward a more nuanced accountability system, or B, the beginning of the end for holding suburban schools accountable?
Well, first, let's just ask a more basic question. Is this legal? Is this something she has the authority to do under the law? And my understanding is that it's not, and neither was the growth pilot that she did. And I think that, you know, that's an important thing, not just in terms of does she have the authority to do this, but in terms of what does this mean in terms of the process of NCLB reauthorization? What sort of things are going to come on the table as a result of things that she's done that she may or may not have had the authority to do? And how is that going to potentially undermine the position that Kennedy and Miller and people who want to support strong accountability in the law are in when the law actually does come before Congress and there's a serious discussion about it, probably not until 2009?
Well, that's a fair question, although I got to believe that she did not put forward this proposal or the growth model proposal without getting Kennedy and Miller's assent. Because obviously, the reauthorization is going nowhere. There's a lot of political interest in moving to this differentiation, and so she moved ahead. But what's your take on this? Is this fair? Of course, we shouldn't group in really bad schools with only somewhat bad schools, or is this really easing up on particularly suburban schools that tend to miss AYP in one or two groups, and now we're going to get some softer label under this proposal?
Well, I think it's still too early to say whether we're going to get softer labels or we're just going to get softer interventions, or if we're actually going to get either as a result of this proposal. They've put forward such a limited amount of details about it so far. What I do think is that there probably is some reasonable trade-off to be made if it's something that's available on the table, between easing up a little bit on suburban schools and in exchange for getting people to really commit to do solid change with the high-risk schools.
See, I don't know if I would take that deal necessarily, because number one, we don't have any examples of any state anywhere really intervening in high poverty, high need schools and being effective. Nobody knows what to do. I'm just very skeptical.
Part of the reason that they're not doing it is because the law doesn't actually force them to do so. That other option that's there for suburban schools lets everybody off the hook
That may be true. But my last point is just that the suburban schools, look, I mean, if a suburban school is doing a terrible job for its black students, should it be let off the hook? Kobe ringing the buzz, I guess, thinks so. All right, that's it. Yes, Liam?
You guys are hardcore about these time deadlines.
Question two. Kobe. Baltimore Superintendent Andres...
that didn't really save any time.
Baltimore Superintendent Andres Alonzo told the city council lately about his reform efforts, quote, "If you're driving and you feel you're in control, you're not going fast enough," unquote. Call this the Paul Vallis approach to district management. Do a million things all at once as fast as you can. Is this the best approach to reforming schools?
Well, my honest answer is I have no idea, because I don't know what I would do if I were in the position of a superintendent. But I can imagine that, yeah, I think this makes some sense. He is moving fast on many, many different fronts. He finally got the teacher union contract nailed down. He announced that he's going to be firing a lot of central office staff. He's reconstituting schools. You walk into an urban school district, you know that you have a limited amount of time to start showing results or else you're going to be sent packing. And so you've got to do lots of things at the same time. I think that makes sense. Other people argue, well, you've got to be focused and it's got to just be about instruction. But I think the reality is you've got to deal with all of these broken systems in a broken school system.
Well, I mean, I'm with you, Mike, in that I have no idea what I would do as a superintendent either. And this question actually cracks me up a little bit because my boyfriend always makes fun of me for driving too slow in the car. But I mostly agree with you, but I guess the more fundamental question to me is, what's the political dynamic that makes people feel like they have a limited time and they need to crunch everything and do it fast? I feel like the political dynamics have to factor in here, both the pressure to do it fast and then also the issues that when you're doing it fast, you often don't necessarily cover your bases politically in ways that could avoid sort of fiascos and meltdowns, and that's an important concern that I would see here, because the political climate is so challenging for real reform that we don't want people to make stupid political mistakes because they're not, covering the bases.
So, Sarah, how slow do you drive?
I drive a little over the speed limit, around the speed limit.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I mean, that's legitimate. I mean, that's, yeah. So you're not like a little old lady.
No.
Okay, Liam, ask us a question that we might know something about.
Question three. Mike, I think this one's geared toward you. The National Institute for Early Education Research just released its annual State of Preschool Yearbook, which is like an annual encyclopedia of state pre-K programs. Why are southern states, which are generally seen as the most conservative, leading the nation when it comes to pre-K? What happens to Head Start as states continue to scale up pre-K? What important quality factors doesn't NIEER account for?
Well, I'm so glad you asked me this question, because I love the State of Preschool Yearbook. I carry it with me everywhere I go. It's part of my training regimen. Now, look, I'm not surprised to hear that Southern states are taking the lead. They have been in the lead in education reform on many things. We certainly see that when we at Fordham do our reviews of state standards, that many of the Southern states have among the best standards, like South Carolina. They were out front on a lot of the accountability things. You know, I think that back in the 80s, the Southern states got the message that if they were going to have a strong economy, they had to get their education system out of the gutter, and they've been working hard at that ever since.
I think that makes a lot of sense, Meg. It's interesting that you mentioned South Carolina, though, because they're a state that has, in law, very strong standards for pre-K, but doesn't actually provide enough money for schools to meet those standards. And we're not even talking about the kind of financial debates that we have in K-12 about how much money is enough. We're talking about like basic amounts of money to hire the number of teachers the law requires you to hire, you know, to hire degree teachers, bachelor's degree teachers, and so on. The NIEER yearbook is a lot like the Center for Education Reform's charter school law rankings in that it provides a ton of really useful information for people about what these, you know, new systems of education delivery that states are building, charters or preschool, really look like. And also, you know, does this rating of the policy environment that's not necessarily a rating of quality in terms of the actual quality of results or the actual right. quality of providers, but looks at, you know, the law and the policies.
Well, let me ask you this, Sarah, very quickly. Why should we have universal pre-K instead of just targeted programs for poor kids?
I think that that's a really good debate that's going on right now. I tend to fall down on the side of universal pre-K largely because school is universal, and it's really important for us to send the message to people that pre-K is not childcare, it's school. And I think that as long as pre-K stays in that targeted box, it's going to be seen as childcare, it's going to be seen as something we do to help poor families work, and it's going to be low quality. We also know that middle-class families struggle a lot to afford pre-K, that near-poor families, families that aren't poor, that are just above the income cutoffs, are less likely to be enrolled in high-quality pre-K than any group, including poor kids. And I think there's a lot of reason that we want to take some of that intervention higher up the income scale. I'm open to sliding scales and some of the other approaches, but ultimately, I think universal is the way to go.
Okay, well, that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Nicely done, Sarah.
Thanks, Mike.
You know, every time you come on the show, I make this comment, but you know, it's been a while. I have to say it again. I feel like the level of discussion is just much higher than when our regular host, Dr. Frederick M. Hess, is here. Rick, you're listening out there. We want you to raise your game the next time you come back. But, you know, he has an excuse. Rick is about to get married. And so, yeah. You know, it's probably, you know, I think, you know, that's a very exciting time. But, you know, it's hard to think about education policy. All right. Well, you know what time it is, everybody. It is time for us to hear about an education outrage of the week. So we're here with Jeff Kuhner with our education outrage of the week. Jeff, what are you outraged about this week?
Mike, there's just so much to be outraged about. You just don't know where to begin. But you know, really, obviously, the Spitzer thing really outraged me, and pervert like that. But and then, you know, with the replacement, did you catch that with Patterson coming on? He's sworn in as mayor, and check this out.
Governor.
Sorry, he's sworn in as governor. Forgive me. And literally 6 hours later, he gives an interview to the New York Daily News saying, oh, by the way, I had numerous affairs. My wife had numerous affairs. But don't hold it against me. And all I'm thinking is, you know, and then McGreevy comes out, the former mayor of New Jersey comes out.
Governor
McGreevy comes out, and he starts saying that he had, you know, they were having threesomes, his wife and his male lover.
Whoa, Jeff, this is a family, a family podcast as well. I'm not sure we need to get into that.
But no, so anyway, speaking of perverts, yes. Here's the education outrage of the week. This stunned me. This was it's an AP story. I have it up. We're going to have it up pretty soon. But the point is that it's out there. It's on the AP wire. Literally, there are Pell Grants for rapists. If you believe in financial aid for sexual predators, then the Pell Grant system is for you. Because apparently, according to the loopholes in Pell Grants, if you're a prison inmate, you cannot receive financial aid. Right. If you are a student convicted of drug offenses, you cannot receive financial aid. So far, so good. But if you are a child molester or a rapist who has served his or her time in prison and then is transferred to a state treatment center for further treatment because you're just too dangerous to be released because you're going to commit more crimes, you are eligible for Pell Grants. So the AP has found through their investigation, millions of taxpayer dollars are flowing to rapists. There's one guy cited in the story, James Sturtz, Iowa's most dangerous sexual predator, a man who has raped women, who openly says if he is released, he will rape and rape and rape again, is receiving money. And check this out, Mike. This is the beauty of it. Instead of taking higher education courses, I don't know, sex 101 or something, what are these guys doing? They take the courses, then they drop them, collect the money, and they buy clothes, sneakers, jackets, TVs, DVD players, CDs. And I'm figuring, well, sure, why not? Get a nice satellite dish and a TV, and you can watch Elliot Spitzer do his little prostitution bit. And then these dumb rapists are probably saying themselves, hey, why did I violate and victimize women? I could have just pulled a Spitzer. I could have paid for sex instead of destroying women's lives to get it. I mean, that to me is the sickness, the absolute sickness of these loopholes. So, Mike, to me, wow, it's outrageous, and these loopholes need to be closed as soon as possible.
So, you know, now let me ask you this, Jeff. If these rapists were in these treatment centers and they were actually using their Pell Grants to get an education, perhaps to get some enlightenment, you know, so that they could go out and be, you know, good citizens, I mean, would you be in favor of that? Or are you just upset that they're actually, basically, that's fraud, they're stealing the money and they're using it?
It is. It's fraud. It's stealing the money. No, my sense on this is, you know, call me a reactionary Neanderthal, but my sense—
And some people do.
And some people do. My sense on this is, I believe there are so many poor students in this country who are literally breaking their backs, working two jobs, going to school full time, flipping hamburgers, waiting on tables. With these limited, precious taxpayer dollars that are available, it should go to law-abiding, deserving citizens, frankly, not to these perverts and sickos who have destroyed women's lives, destroyed children's lives. To me, they deserve some rehabilitation, but I don't think they should be eligible for financial aid. Call me crazy.
Okay, Jeff Kooner with his Education Outrage of the Week. Thank you, Jeff. Sarah, over at New America, you cover, New America covers these issues quite a bit. Your colleague,
yeah,
Michael Dannenberg,
yeah,
is one of the leading experts on Pell Grants and the like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's your take on this?
You know, I don't do a lot of the higher ed work, but I think I'll ask my colleagues at Higher Ed Watch blog if they have any views on this, then people can check that out in
the
coming
weeks. Yeah, ask them about Pell Grants for rape.
Yeah. I'd be, you know, curious about that. Yeah, I mean, you know, might be a real debate. Well, I mean, the fundamental question is, on all these government programs, if somebody commits a crime and then does the time, should they be eligible for that kind of government program later? And there is this tweak where if you're convicted of a drug offense, you're not allowed to. But, you know, I assume any other crime you can commit and you can still, if you do your time, go back and get a Pell Grant.
I don't know. I'll ask them to check it out.
All right.
Thank you.
Please do.
Yeah. I will.
Report
I will.
Back to us. That'd
yes,
be great.
I will.
All right. We'll check that out. Well, it is now everyone's favorite time of the week. That time we wait for all week long, education news of the weird time. With our special education news of the weird correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, welcome back. What's weird this week?
Mike, you are not going to believe this. Okay. Education.
Well, Liam, we just had a segment on Pell Grants for rapists. Try me.
Education news of the weird this week comes to us from Orlando, Florida, where a teacher, Jamaica Chambers, apparently told her student, her 13-year-old student, to urinate in a lunchbox. I am not making this up. Mike, it is weird. Let me tell you. Okay, here's the backstory.
Liam, are you doing education news of the weird or education outrage of
Mike,
the week?
Listen to this. Mike, I'm telling you, this is weird stuff. The kid is in class. He has to use the bathroom, and he asks to go to the bathroom. Miss Chambers tells him, and I kid you not, she tells him, you can either hold it, or you can urinate in my lunchbox. The 13-year-old male goes up to the front of the class, grabs his teacher's lunchbox, returns to the back of the class, hides behind a bookshelf, urinates in the lunchbox, and then gives it to Miss Jamaica Chambers. And then the next day, this kid's mother shows up at school, mm-hmm, tells the principal how outraged she is about this,
yep,
and contacts the news. Mm-hmm. And so they show up with a camera truck. And that's Education News of the Weird.
Well, this is not even a first.
What was that, Sarah?
This isn't a first. There was an issue a couple of years ago in another school where a teacher told children to use soda bottles.
I think we covered that.
You probably heard about that here on the podcast.
Probably.
Yeah. I mean, a lunchbox? Like, was there a seal? I mean, what?
Well, this is a good question. And this gets to the crux of the issue, Mike, which is, here's what I think about this. You have students in class who are urinating in lunchboxes. Okay?
Yes, right.
It's ridiculous. Teachers need to know not to encourage their students to urinate in lunchboxes. Who knows what's next? Someone needs to be fired. The people involved with this need to be held accountable.
You see, now, Sarah, here's the problem. Here's the problem. You know, it's like when, you know that we recently had a baby.
In the
office, Eric Osberg, he just had their second baby. You know, there's always sibling rivalries. Ever since we brought Jeff on the show with his education outrage bit, I just think he's been a little jealous. He's been a little morose. And we've encouraged him to step it up, react to the competition, But here it is, that imitation is the best form of flattery. Is that what's going on here, Liam?
I'm just trying to do what I can do to enlighten our listeners.
But I think our listeners, they want Education News of the Weird, Liam. They don't want a double dose of Education Outrage of the Week.
These stories, you can't ignore them.
Somebody should be fired.
I think there was radical Islam involved in this story somehow.
Yes. Maybe Elliot Spitzer. Okay, well, that is all the time we have for this week. Thank you for listening. Until next time.
I'm Sarah Mead.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.